I'm very pleased to welcome back to View from the Roundhouse Professor Martin Drum from Notre Dame University, usually based here in Fremantle. Martin, where are you today?
Oh no, I'm here in Fremantle today. I was just grabbing a coffee, as us Frio people tend to do, Michael.
If you're in Sydney today, they'd be having a, well, they are having a public holiday, especially up and down the south and north coasts, I suppose, Martin.
That's right. And so I've got a relatively quiet Monday, so I'm looking forward to that, Michael.
If you were in Broome, you would probably be out on Cable Beach having a coffee at a swim, Martin.
Oh, look, it doesn't get much nicer than going out to Broome at this time of the year. It is a stunning place, and their dry season is just amazing.
And what about Lyon, France, Martin? Does Notre Dame have an outpost there?
Well, we do go there from time to time. It's not the worst place to go to as well. So, very fortunate to travel to a number of lovely destinations.
And the TGV isn't all that far from Paris when you think about it, Martin.
I think it's about an hour and a half by train, so it's not too bad.
But Martin, everything's happening in the world. If we want anything ever to talk about when we don't know what to talk about, we just say Donald Trump, Elon Musk, and of course they're at it. We won't talk about them today. It's like accentuating the wrongdoing and silliness of a couple of naughty boys in the classroom. We'll see what happens during the week and talk about it next Friday. But tell me this, how's Susan Lee doing so far, in your estimation?
Oh, look, I think that she started pretty well. The catastrophe around their split and reunion with the Nationals was really the Nationals doing, in my assessment. I think there was a number of people in the Nationals that wanted to make a stand. Then they realised how messy that would be. But she's been able to promote a number of new faces that have come through and people that probably needed an opportunity. And I think this talk of modernizing the Liberal parties, probably the right language to use. And she's starting to frame immigration as an economic issue rather than a security issue, which I think is a smart way to go about it. And that's part of that modernizing the message. If you've only got one shtick and it's around the threat that immigrants provide, then I don't think you're actually going to be modernizing the Liberal Party. So focusing on economic issues for me is where the Liberal Party should be more.
Martin, I suspect or know that there's also a question of style when we men who are used to doing locker room talk with the footy boys sort of thing then have to walk out into the real world and have a normal conversation with a woman. We have to do a little bit of adjusting. And I think male parliamentarians used to the hustle and bustle of what goes in on the corridor are no exception. How do you think Elbo will go on this front dealing with the demure Susan Lee, who at times, of course, can be not so demure.
Well, it's going to provide a different type of challenge for him. It's worth us all remembering she's the first Liberal leader, female Liberal leader, in Liberal Party's history. So the federal, and that's pretty extraordinary. So I think he'll have to adjust. He'll be mindful about how much he should attack the Liberal Party's first female leader. So I imagine he's probably getting lots of advice on that. But I think look, it doesn't change all of those structural issues around appealing to women, but everyone's got to admit it's a start. It's probably a step in the right direction.
Martin, I've never forgotten as a 16-year-old boy at a boys' school going to debate three girls from a girls' school and being absolutely trashed by them. The male adjudicator just found that they won by so much. And I think the difference was that the boys, me included, engaged in histrionics and the girls just spoke sense and won by a long way. And I suppose that's what Susan Lee might bring to this debate.
Yeah, I guess it's really early days. I mean, we don't want to over-egg things. She's only just taken on the mantle. She's had some personal tragedy as well, which is well documented. So I guess you're only going to see after 6 to 12 months how well she'll go. Bear in mind, she only won the leadership battle by 25 to 22 votes and also relied on three departing senators and a member for Bradfield who's no longer the member for Bradfield. Michael. Well, she never really was the member for Bradfield, to be technically correct. She was presumed elected at the time, and the recount has shown that she's not actually elected as member for Bradfield. So, yeah, the numbers in the party room were pretty tight.
The Bradfield election's really terribly interesting. It went to a recount and just 26 odd votes in it, Martin. I suppose a win's a win. It doesn't matter by how many or how few. It'll be interesting to watch the Teals in the new parliament, Martin.
That's right. So, one Teal lost her seat in Goldstein in Victoria to Tim Wilson, and another one picked up one in Bradfield. So, same numbers as before. A big, broad crossbench with his massive majority. Anthony Albanese could well ignore them, but I think he'd be smart not to, and to look after them to such an extent that they provide a bulwark for him against the Liberal Party, because if the Liberal Party can't win back those seats, it's very difficult for them to be winning government.
Another woman he might have to sort of, the appropriate metaphor here, take notice of, Martin, is Dorinda Cox, who used to make a noise in the Greens in the Senate, has walked across the aisle and joined the Labor Party, apparently with the blessing, encouragement, or invitation, or whatever, of the Prime Minister. What do you make of that move? And shouldn't someone, particularly if they're in the Senate, being elected for a party, have to leave the parliament if they decide they're not going to be a member of the party anymore?
Yes, this has been one of the most interesting developments. Dorinda Cox leaving the Greens to join the Labor Party, having been elected as a Greens senator from Western Australia. These moves are always disconcerting, in my view. I think in the Senate, you do get elected as part of a party, and that's very clear. And that's what voters are doing. And you can see them doing that when voting above the line. And so party hopping is unsavoury business, and it doesn't matter which direction that it takes place. I think people have a right to be aggrieved, and certainly the Greens here in Western Australia are deeply unhappy. Bear in mind, Albanese himself complained bitterly when Fatima Payman left the Labor Party not too long ago to become an independent. I've got a little bit more sympathy, Michael, for people that become independents, because you can fall out with your party over significant issues. And Fatima Payman, at least, whether you agree or disagree with her, had a profound difference, I believe, with the Liberal Party over Palestine, and left the party around that issue. Whereas Dorinda Cox's issues appear to be predominantly personal. She was overlooked for the deputy leadership's role. She doesn't have a good relationship with a number of other people in the party. There were no discernible ideological differences that explain her move. So I think they're not exactly the same situation. But I think if you're elected as part of a party in the Senate, you should really be seeing out your term under that paradigm.
It'll be interesting. They say the Labor Party is a broad church, clear factions within it, broad left, the broad right. I don't know if there's anyone left in the centre, but where do they invite Dorinda Cox to go, do you think, in that broad church?
It's an interesting one, because if she doesn't sit in a faction, what happens at pre-selection? This was the other thing that I ne neglected to mention. There was chatter amongst the Greens about whether she would be pre-selected next time round. Well, for Labor, their pre-selection process is pretty clear in that it goes to the left and the right factions. So it depends on whether she's able to join a faction, perhaps. I can't see factions being particularly willing to overlook one of their own that have been there waiting in the queue for a long time, Michael, for such a shot, or sitting senators for that matter, overlook those kind of candidates for Dorinda Cox. So it could be a pretty tough path to being pre-selected again. Probably the only hope that she might have is a bit like Senator Pat Dodson, where the Prime Minister and or party leader says, "I want that person in my team." So he could try and use a captain's call, Michael, but it's a pretty big call in Dorinda Cox's case.
Well, you'd think it is. Do you think Elbow might be wishing, at least before long, I'll be wishing he hadn't been so receptive to the idea of her arriving? What does she bring to the party?
Well, she brings an extra number, I guess. In theory, if we look at the numbers in the Senate, if they get Liberal or Coalition support, they get their legislation passed. If they get Green support, they get their legislation passed. With this additional number, in theory, they could use a motley coalition of other crossbenchers to pass legislation. I think that's quite unlikely because it involves One Nation senators. Pretty unlikely to support government legislation, usually, I would have thought. So it is an additional senator. I think that Albanese probably thinks he can carry this off because he's riding a high and he's very dominant politically. But these things can come back to bite you. We know that Dorinda Cox has experienced a lot of challenges in her office with a lot of staff departing amid bullying allegations, etc. He wouldn't want controversies to swirl around a senator like that he's welcomed into the team, especially as he knows about those controversies before she came.
Martin, we'll watch that development with interest over the next few months, I'm sure. But there's one question that's on every Tasmanian's lips at the moment, Martin, and that is whether, like the Eagles way back when they came into the AFL, eventually the new Tassie Devils AFL team will win their first game. But I suppose there's a big presumption there. Will there be the Devils, Tassie Devils AFL football team, do you think? And what does it hinge on, Martin? Why are we talking about
Well, the devil may be in the detail here.
it?
Pun intended. There's a strange thing going on where Tasmanians, according to the polls, appear to want an AFL team, but appear uncomfortable with the increasingly high price tag for building brand new huge stadium. Well, I shouldn't say huge. It's only seats in the 20s, 20, I don't know, high 20K. But it's a very expensive price tag. It's reaching $1 billion, which for a state of Tasmania is a lot of money. It keeps going up. Tasmania has a stadium in Launceston. They've got a stadium in Belrive Stadium already in Hobart. And I think that the price tag is making a lot of Tasmanians uncomfortable. But the AFL have said, you're not getting a team unless you commit to this stadium, unless we get the new stadium to house it. Anyway, this is all part of a much bigger story at the moment, and that's that the Tasmanian opposition has moved a motion of no confidence in the government, and with the support of crossbenchers, it's got up. I should say, I'm being technically incorrect, they've moved a motion of no confidence in the Premier,
What's the
which is not
difference?
exactly the same thing.
Isn't it?
Well, it's not because when Parliament expresses no confidence in the Premier has to resign. If Parliament expresses a motion of no confidence in the government needs to resign. There is a subtle difference there. So, in theory, Jeremy Rockliffe could resign and the party finds another Premier and they keep going. In reality, he's calling Labor's bluff and said, well, I'm going to go off to the governor and request an election. These shenanigans are taking place in the Tasmanian Parliament at the moment. In the meantime, the budget has not been passed. They can't pay their workers and other essential bills they need to pay. So their lieutenant governor, that's the guy that steps in when the governor's away, has advised the premier that he does need to ensure that the supply to government is maintained. Government will sit, Parliament, sorry, will sit. And they will pass that, I believe, on Monday. And on Tuesday, he'll be back in the governor's office, this time with the governor herself, who will provide advice to him. And governors don't, under these circumstances, don't always have to accept the premier's advice.
What are the options?
Well, there's only a few, there's not many. Option one is that she accepts the government's advice and agrees to call an election. Dissolve Parliament and call an election, probably the easiest solution. But the Parliament's not that old. And sometimes when Parliament is it's not long out of an election, the governor says to them, well, it's your job to go back and find, you're still the government. It's your job to find another leader because you've been knocked off. So she could actually advise him to go back and find a new premier. She could even potentially invite the opposition leader to try and form government. So there's different options there at her disposal. So often, not long after an election, the governor will take the view that the people have spoken, they've elected that parliament, and that parliament needs to get down to business of governing. So I've actually seen instances where the acting premier has tried to recommend another election, and the governor said, "No, you go and sort it out."
I'd say there'd be a fair chance of that happening here, although it's complicated from what I understand, Martin, and that is that Labor, who obviously don't have the numbers to be in government after the last election, also say they won't go into coalition with the Greens. If they were prepared to do that, then they would have the numbers, and that'll be in the governor's mind, no doubt. Why don't you go back, see if anyone else wants to form a government? That might put the acid on Labor and the Greens to behave. Why put the electorate through another election when they've had one recently? The numbers are there. Something could come out of it. Of course, if that's messy, the only thing to do is have another election. But what's that going to prove? They all agree there's both parties, major parties, agree that there should be a new AFL team with its own stadium, Martin. It's only a few recalcitrants in their funny little council who are opposed.
Well, this I should point out, they will require other crossbenchers to join them, Labor and the Greens, to form government, which is messy. But your point's still valid. And the interesting thing, back to our stadium discussion, is Labor's never been either opposed to the team or opposed to the stadium per se. They've just been very critical of the increased costs. So that's the bizarre thing here. I think the governor would be well within her rights to ask either the government or afford the government or the opposition the opportunity to form government. But if they've publicly stated that they won't, she could perhaps order another election. It's only 14 months after the last election, which is less than halfway into its term.
Well, in a sense, this has been coming all the time. You'd think if you were the governor, you'd simply say, look, you go away and sort this out. You just can't keep going off to elections. That's just adding to the mess. But I guess, Martin, we'll find out. Are you making any bold predictions?
I'm not on this occasion. I think that these things have they have a habit of turning up surprises.
Martin, I have a very strong feeling in my bones that the Tassie Devils will eventually play their first game. And do you have a bold prediction as to who'll win that game at either the new or the old stadium?
I think that we'll have a Tassie Devils team. I think there's too much on the line for Tasmania. This is, I mean, football's the biggest sport there. It's their chance to go on the stage. I know they've got a few other teams like basketball teams, etc. But this is big bickies, and neither side of politics wants to lose that. So I think we'll see it happen.
Martin, the Ukraine Defence Forces had a few successes during the week, blowing things up here and there, bombers, parts of bridges. Was all that part of a negotiating technique, or is it part of a serious ongoing war? Are we going to see the Ukraine conflict resolved any day, week, month, year, decade soon?
Well, I think it's looking less likely of being resolved quickly. I think that both sides were making some noises before Ukraine's attack on Russia. It's probably infuriated the Russians. But it is rather ironic that the country that invaded another country appears infuriated whenever they get attacked back. It's like the big brother that picks on the little brother and then gets upset when they get a bloody nose. So, look, this attack that we're talking about, this drone attack on the Russian air fleet, is extraordinary. It was incredibly well executed, appears to have done significant damage, and has taken Russia by complete surprise. So, I think their focus now on retaliation, and Donald Trump, who was talking up peace at various times, It stopped doing so. And I mean, he doesn't like, Donald Trump likes quick fixes. I think that he may well just decide to abandon this or change tack completely. He's pretty unpredictable in these things. So if he just can't get the parties to agree, we might see a complete change in his policy.
Martin, if it drags out, which you don't really want to think about, but sort of common sense tells you it's already dragged out, why wouldn't it drag out for another 2 or 3 or 5 years? Why won't it look like Vietnam or Afghanistan or Sudan or you name it?
And sometimes both parties, the devastating toll on both parties is such that that peace becomes a realistic possibility. And I think probably there's some hope. And look, to be fair to Donald Trump, Michael, or, he's probably copped a fair bit of criticism from both of us at one time or another. I think he was genuine in trying to end the war. I think he's been. Yeah, I think he's probably just overthought his ability to do so. And he certainly, I think, overthought his ability to influence Putin. I think that's his biggest mistake. He thought that because they were pals, that Putin would be happy to go along with this. And it's clearly not the case. I think it might have been, noble intentions, so to speak. But we're no closer to ending that war than we were before he took office.
Well, Blind Freddie knew that Putin wasn't going to take any notice really of Trump when all of this started, but that's another topic. As is Trump and Elon, as I said at the very outset, we'll see what the settling of the dust discloses by next Friday. But Martin, as we draw this view from the roundhouse to a conclusion, we still keep skirting around the question of an economic policy as a topic. I think we need to have a special edition of the view with a view to talking about one of those issues, Martin. What do you think?
I think that'd be great. I think a special edition would be a fantastic idea.
Okay, let's do it next week. Keep an eye out, listeners and readers of Fremantle Shipping News. And in the meantime, have a restful week like the Fremantle Dockers who are playing great footy. And we've still got the same coach, even though only a matter of a month ago everyone wanted him sacked. Hung, drawn, quartered.
I did hear Justin Longmuir speak at the Fremantle Chamber of Commerce, Michael, recently. He spoke exceptionally well. I think he's got some clear leadership qualities there.
He might finish up as an executive dean of Notre Dame University now.
There's always room for someone like that.
See you next week, Martin.
Take care.